This is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. I'm filling in for George Douglas, who's out for the next 2 weeks, so I'll be here next week as well, but he'll be back shortly. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And today we're reading from the issue dated April the 5th, 2013. We begin then with the section titled The Main Stories and How They Were Covered. The first one is Gay Marriage Comes Before the Supreme Court. What happened? The Supreme Court signaled a cautious approach to determining the constitutionality of gay marriage this week as it confronted one of today's key civil rights issues for the first time. The court heard arguments on both California's Proposition 8, which outlined same-sex marriage in the state back in 2008, and the Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA, DOMA, the 1996 federal law defining marriage as only a legal union between one man and one woman, quote-unquote. Marriage equality advocates hoped the court would toss out Proposition 8, opening the door for legalizing gay marriage in all 50 states. But in oral arguments, the court's conservative wing showed itself reluctant to pass judgment. Justice Anthony Kennedy, seen as the swing vote on the divided court, said the court was entering, quote unquote, into uncharted waters, and suggested that there was too little sociological information on gay marriage to rule on it. If the justices decide to dismiss the case, a lower court ruling overturning California's ban will stand. A majority of the justices did voice support for striking down DOMA, however, a decision that would allow married same-sex couples to receive the same federal benefits as other spouses. While conservatives on the court found little problem with the federal law, the liberal wing implied that it violated the civil rights of same-sex couples. DOMA creates a tiered system of marriage, said Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, full marriage and then this sort of skim milk marriage. Kennedy also criticized the law, but for violating states' rights. The court is expected to issue a ruling on both cases before July. What the editorial said. We favor a, quote-unquote, broad ruling striking down both Proposition 8 and DOMA, said the Los Angeles Times. That would give all same-sex couples a constitutionally protected right to marry. Gays and lesbians are seeking not some newfangled right, but participation in the venerable and essential institution of marriage. Still, the consequences of a narrow ruling wouldn't be catastrophic, said Bloomberg.com. Simply dismissing the Proposition 8 case, as Kennedy seemed disposed to do, would signal support of same-sex marriage, while allowing public opinion to further coalesce. Why not let the people decide, said the Wall Street Journal. It's true that public support is growing. 9 states now recognize same-sex marriages, up from 0 less than a generation ago. The court should stand back and allow popular acceptance to grow on its own, rather than impose a judicial diktat on the 31 states whose voters have endorsed traditional marriage. Let change come as and when the electorate chooses to accept new values and norms. What the columnist said. While the court labors over its decision, the country has moved on, said Maureen Down in the New York Times. Some 58% of Americans now support gay marriage and 81% of those under 30 do. Yet fuddy-duddies on the court like Kennedy seem to want to duck the issue. Fine, but America has already made its mind up. And if this court doesn't reject bigotry, history will reject the court. Gay marriage acceptance still isn't an overwhelming juggernaut, said Jonathan V. Last in WeeklyStandard.com. Even in ultra-liberal Washington state, only a narrow majority voted in favor of gay marriage. So thank goodness for Justice Antonin Scalia, said Daniel Foster in NationalReview.com, for noting this week that the Constitution doesn't mention homosexuality or marriage. In the end, it will be some version of this worry, not Kennedy's dithering, that will stop the court from ruling rashly in favor of gay marriage for all. Let's not forget that reading the tea leaves of oral arguments is risky business, said Michael Crowley in Times.com. About this time last year, the Affordable Care Act came before the justices. Court watchers eagerly informed us that the Obama administration's lawyers had foundered in court and said the justices were, quote-unquote, poised to strike it down. We all remember how that turned out. So rather than parsing Kennedy's tantalizingly inconclusive words for a possible outcome, maybe we should just sit back and watch one of the great historic civil rights debates of our lifetimes. Also under the main stories, we have this, Bloomberg's anti-gun push. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg this week stepped up his already prominent role in the debate over gun control, announcing that he would spend $12 million of his own money on an advertising campaign to pressure Congress into expanding background checks for gun buyers. The ads, one of which featured a gun-wielding hunter saying, "Background checks have nothing to do with taking guns away from anyone," will target 15 senators in 13 states. Later this month, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is expected to put a gun control package to a vote. Having removed the assault weapons ban that he felt lacked sufficient support in Congress. National Rifle Association Chief Wayne LaPierre has finally met his match, said Newsday in an editorial. On NBC's Meet the Press, he said, Bloomberg can't spend enough of his $27 billion to try to impose his will on the American public. But what has LaPierre's gun lobby been doing all these years, if not imposing its will on Congress with the help of millions of dollars happily anteed up by American firearms manufacturers? LaPierre's is just sore that the NRA, with 4.5 million members and a $300 million budget, is finally being rivaled in funding and fervor. Actually, Bloomberg's activism is the best thing to happen to the pro-gun lobby for years, said Noah Rothman in Mediate.com. People are sick to death of Nanny-in-Chief Bloomberg and his unashamed efforts to ban or curtail any pleasures he deems remotely harmful, including smoking and sugary drinks. Now he's after our guns. People outside the East Coast are bound to reject this latest expression of Bloomberg's unvarnished progressivism. It's going to be an interesting battle, said Chris Saliza and Sean Sullivan in WashingtonPost.com. Bloomberg's support for background checks is shared by almost 90% of the American public, and he may be the only person wealthy enough and stubborn enough to push this law through. Still, it's hard to see how $12 million spent in March of an off year will have a tremendous persuasive effect on the incumbents. But even if Bloomberg is tilting at windmills here, the pro-gun forces would be foolish to discount this formidable influence of one of the most compelling actors in the political world. That takes us to the section of the magazine entitled Controversy of the Weeks. And we have here an article entitled Drones, Will a Pentagon Takeover Make a Difference? The CIA appears to be getting out of the drone business, said Dashiell Bennett in TheAtlantic.com. Senior U.S. officials last week indicated that the White House plans to shift control of the CIA's lethal unmanned aircraft to the Department of Defense. That would add much-needed transparency and accountability to what has become one of the government's most controversial operations. The CIA now operates the drones that target and kill suspected terrorists in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, and other countries where the U.S. is not officially at war. Because those missions are deemed covert, the administration can deny their existence to Congress, shielding those responsible from accountability when a drone strike goes wrong and incinerates civilians. Under the Pentagon, however, the drone war would be subject to international military law and congressional oversight. This is a good thing all around, said Michael Leiter in MSNBC.com. Freed from paramilitary activities, the CIA can return to its traditional role of strategic intelligence collection and analysis. But as with everything involving drone policy, there are complications, said Bloomberg.com in an editorial. When the military wants a drone strike on foreign soil, it first has to get the approval of the nation's government. How will the White House respond if al-Qaeda forces take harbor in a country with an anti-American government? The president has an easy way out of that bind, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. It seems likely that the drone fleet will be placed under the Joint Special Operations Command, which runs the SEALs, Delta Force, and other clandestine units. Although JSOC is part of the armed forces, an executive order signed by President George W. Bush gives it authority to conduct secret operations against al-Qaeda and affiliated terrorist networks worldwide. So drone strikes could remain as frequent and far-flung as ever under the Pentagon, and maybe even more so, since Bush's executive order allows JSOC to conduct its covert missions without reporting to congressional intelligence committees, as the CIA must do. Rather than reform his drone program, Obama should scrap it, said Rafia Zakaria in AlJazeera.com. The extremists being targeted by drones do not seem at all weakened by them. Over the past 4 years, the president has ordered more than 300 drone attacks in Pakistan, killing some 2,000 Islamic militants, as well as hundreds of civilians. Yet terrorist attacks in the country have continued to rise. Last year, there were at least 652 of them, up from 473 in 2010. Militants have wised up to being easy prey for drones in Pakistan's sparsely populated northwest, where the war against the Pakistani Taliban and al-Qaeda was once centered. Many have moved to bustling cities like Karachi and Quetta, knowing the U.S. wouldn't dare launch a Hellfire missile into an urban area. Like it or not, this move will entrench targeted killing policy for the long term, said Michael Waxman in foreignpolicy.com. The covert status of CIA drone strikes made it difficult for officials to explain and justify them. With the Pentagon in charge, the government can start talking about the program's importance at home and abroad. The perception of stricter oversight will also make drone policy more legitimate in the public's eyes. Polling shows that Americans would rather the military commanded the drone fleet than the CIA, so this move will strengthen political backing for continued strikes. So even if their controllers are changing, America's killer drones are here to stay. That brings us to the section entitled, Good Week For, Bad Week For. Well, it seems like it was a good week for tying up loose ends, after Pope Francis phoned the owner of a Buenos Aires newspaper kiosk to cancel his daily paper. Seriously, it's Jorge Bergoglio, the Pope said. I'm calling you from Rome. And it's been a good week for handouts. After an aspiring British pinup model who claimed her flat chest was causing her emotional distress, received free 36DD breast implants from the National Health Service. "The sky's the limit now that I've got my new boobs," said Josie Cunningham, 22. And it seems to be a good week for the Ninth Life. After a missing cat was found alive in the walls of an Indiana home, 1 week after a private jet crashed into that house, and just moments before it was to be demolished with a wrecking ball. "If that cat didn't spend 8 of its lives," said a neighbor, "I don't know what other cat has." However, it was a bad week for calamari, after a Chinese fishmonger found a 3-pound live bomb inside a squid he was cutting up. Police took the squid away and blew it up in a controlled explosion. Also a bad week for bucket lists, after Boston police found a scribbled checklist on a suspected burglar, Evan Dorsey, that included such goals as find crystal meth, sell drugs, rob a dealer, and do one altruistic thing for a stranger. It was also a bad week for democracy after Councilman Steve Adams of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, called 911 to demand that police arrest a city attorney who had called him a moron. Adams also took his complaint to Mayor Sandy Bloom, who, he said, raised her fist and said she had half a mind to punch my nose off my face. Takes us into the people section of the Week magazine, and we start out with an article entitled Rodman and the Dictator. "Dennis Rodman has made a friend for life," said Graham Guilford in The Sun, UK. While filming a basketball documentary in North Korea recently, the retired NBA star hung out with the country's reclusive dictator, Kim Jong-un. Rodman found the nuclear-armed tyrant to be surprisingly down-to-earth. Kim is not one of those Saddam Hussein-type characters that he wants to take over the world, said the former Chicago Bull. "He's a cool guy who wears everyday regular clothes and likes music and sports and stuff." Rodman bonded with the 30-year-old despot over a 15-course banquet at his Pyongyang palace. "I couldn't believe how much we had to talk about. He loves basketball and told me he's worn my jersey, number 91, every day since he was a kid." After the feast, Rodman partied with Kim and other regime members in a grand ballroom. "It was wackadoo. Kim loves 1980s disco music. There was an all-girl band playing, and we were definitely getting down." Outside the palace, Rodman saw a few signs of the poverty and oppression that have made North Korea an international pariah. He noticed that ordinary citizens on the street never smiled, but think that's because they were busy, not miserable. Rodman plans to return to Pyongyang this summer. "I can't wait," he says. "I'll be staying in the royal palace." And then there's this story under the People section entitled The Icequake Survivor. Rosie Stancer was raised to be a lady, not a polar explorer, said Lucy Cavendish in The Times, UK. A great-niece of Britain's late Queen Mother, Stancer discovered her vocation in 1996 when she heard a radio program about a planned all-female expedition to the North Pole. "I was in the bath," said the 53-year-old. "I jumped up and told William," her husband, "I needed to go on that expedition." Since then, she has trekked to the South Pole twice and is about to leave her husband and 11-year-old son, Jock, to make her second solo attempt on the North Pole. Her first, in 2007, ended badly, she says. "Everything seemed to conspire against me. Besides losing two toes to frostbite, she nearly died in an ice quake. I heard a terrifying noise like ice cubes rattling. There were mountains of ice coming down towards me in folds. She grabbed her sleds and ran, but I knew I couldn't outrun it. So I sat down and took out the picture Jacques had drawn for me before I left and stared at it. In its squiggles, she saw her son's face. He was looking at me, smiling. I felt calm. I knew I was going to miss Jacques, she said, blinking rapidly. But the end was nigh. And that takes us to the section of the magazine entitled Briefing. And we have this article, Sexual Assault in the Military. The Pentagon is struggling to quell an epidemic of sexual abuse in the armed services hierarchical culture. How rife is sexual crime in the services? It has become a grave concern, particularly as uniformed women take on more roles. Military sexual trauma, which encompasses everything from sexual harassment to rape, is now the leading cause of post-traumatic stress disorder among women in the U.S. military. Female soldiers today are 180 times more likely to be sexually assaulted by a fellow soldier than killed by an enemy. Sufferers often spiral downward into alcohol and substance abuse, depression, and homelessness. It just pulls the skin off you, said one former Army Reserve officer who retreated to a mobile home deep in the woods after she was assaulted. But sexual abuse often goes unreported. In 2011, there were around 3,000 official cases of military sexual assault, but a report commissioned by then-Defense Secretary Leon Panetta put the actual annual number at 19,000 or more. An anonymous survey of more than 1,100 women who served in Afghanistan and Iraq, conducted last year by the Department of Veterans Affairs, found that almost half said they had been sexually harassed, and nearly one quarter said they had been sexually assaulted. Why is abuse so rarely reported? Victims tend to be young, of low rank, and too intimidated to speak out. Often the superior a soldier reports to is a friend of the perpetrator, or even the perpetrator himself. How am I supposed to go about reporting something when the person I'm supposed to report to is the person who raped me? Said Virginia Messick, one of 62 trainees assaulted by instructors at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio between 2009 and 2012. Victims often figure that an investigation is likely to turn into a he-said-she-said battle that the senior soldier is bound to win. Brigadier General Jeffrey Sinclair, who was arraigned by a military court earlier this year on charges of forcible sodomy and sexual misconduct, was initially unconcerned when subordinates questioned his conduct. Quote, unquote, "I'm a general," he reportedly said. "I'll do whatever the F I want." What happens when an incident is reported? Too often, nothing at all. A shocking 92% of reported assaults never come before a military court. First responders frequently fail to collect forensic evidence of an assault within the 72-hour deadline stipulated by current guidelines, and more often than not, the victim's superior decides against proceeding to court-martial anyway. Last year, two-thirds of all reported cases were either summarily dismissed as unfounded or resolved by the perpetrators simply being given extra duties or having their pay docked. Of the few defendants referred to court-martial, a tenth opt to resign instead. By admitting their guilt and accepting the perceived punishment of leaving the military, they can avoid prosecution, civilian or military, altogether. And before any case goes to trial, a military judge can issue a summary verdict of consensual sex, quote-unquote, that ends the proceedings. And that's what happened to Army Reserve PFC Sasha Garner, who waited 3 hours in a courthouse in Bagram, Afghanistan, before she was informed of that decision. "I just started bawling my eyes out," said Garner. "How can they rule it consensual without even hearing my side of the story?" What's being done to change things? Last year, days after watching The Invisible War, an Oscar-nominated documentary on sexual assaults in the military, Defense Secretary Panetta announced the creation of a special victims unit in each branch of the military. He implemented new procedures that allow soldiers who report an assault to be transferred out of their units so they're not subject to pressure or further harassment. Panetta also announced that higher-ranking colonels, rather than unit commanders, would decide whether to prosecute cases of sexual assault. Why not handle that outside the command structure? Some have suggested that the U.S. follow the practice of other countries, such as the U.K., by forming an independent military judiciary to rule on sexual assault cases. Such an administrative structure would prevent troubling cases like that of Lieutenant Colonel James Wilkerson, an Air Force pilot who was convicted last year of aggravated sexual assault and sentenced to a year in military prison. In February, Air Force Lieutenant General Craig Franklin summarily dismissed Wilkerson's conviction as, quote-unquote, without merit, and reinstated him to the Air Force, as he is allowed to do, quote-unquote, for any reason or no reason under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said last month that the case raises a significant question about whether commanders should have that power and ordered a review. Finally, what women would be at greatest risk in combat? Some conservatives contend that they would be at greater risk in combat, but the Pentagon says having females on the front line would more likely reduce the military sexual assault rates. Currently, said General Martin Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you have one part of the population that's designated as warriors and another part designated as something else. Given the sex's equal roles would dispel that disparity and the dangerous psychology it fosters, Dempsey suggested, prompting a real change in military culture. For Jenny McClendon, a Navy officer raped by her superior, that can't come soon enough. I don't want another generation to feel like they're alone, she said. Those serving today, I don't want them betrayed. Takes us to Best Columns, the U.S., and we start out with this article entitled, Our Patently Unreasonable Drinking Age, and it's written by Charles C.W. Cook in the National Review. At age 18, Americans may marry, vote, buy a house, and fight for their country, said Charles C.W. Cook. But they can't legally buy an alcoholic drink until they're 21. This inconsistency is grotesque. If this law exists to protect young adults from their base impulses, shouldn't we raise the age limit for, say, marriage? After all, young lust can lead to inordinately bad decisions, just ask Romeo and Juliet. Of course, alcohol can be destructive, but so can paint thinner. Yet no politician demands age limits for the patrons of Home Depot. The drinking age was raised in the 1980s when Mothers Against Drunk Driving argued that teenage drinking led to drunk driving deaths. The evidence for that link is by no means indisputable, but in 1984, Congress passed the National Minimum Drinking Age Act, which punishes any state that sets a drinking age below 21 with a 10% reduction in federal highway funds. This legalized bribery is a glaring example of federal overreach of states' rights and individual liberty. It should be a libertarian's dream issue. What a shame that Republicans lack the courage to repeal this open joke of a law. Also, under Best Columns the U.S., we see this piece by Ezra Klein, WashingtonPost.com, entitled, A Budget Only Democrats Could Love. For 4 years, Republicans have relentlessly chided Senate Democrats for failing to produce a budget, said Ezra Klein. Last week, the Democrats finally did so, and the GOP may be sorry it ever pushed them. It's not that the Republicans are worried about the document actually being implemented. That will never happen. But they may be vexed that the Senate's budget proposal sits to the left of the deal President Obama is currently offering. Along with the White House itself, the GOP long suspected that the Senate Democrats had little spine on taxes and that when push came to shove, they would balk at Obama's radical priorities for more revenue. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, the Republicans figured, was refusing to release a budget only to hide the deep fissures in the party. But the GOP has now been proved wrong. Senate Democrats called for almost $1 trillion in tax hikes, or roughly $375 billion more than Obama has asked for lately. To the GOP's disappointment, instead of a Democratic budget it envisioned as undercutting the White House leverage, it got one that makes the White House look downright moderate by comparison. That brings us to The Last Word. And the article for The Last Word this week is entitled, A Generation of Interns. Breaking into many fields today, says Hannah Seligson, may take one poorly paid internship after another. And this is copyrighted 2013 by Hannah Seligson from a longer article originally published in Washingtonian. In many ways, Kate is a perfect reflection of the opportunities and hardships of being young today. She's smart and motivated and has a degree from an Ivy League school, yet at 25 she worries she'll never attain the status or lifestyle of her boomer parents. She majored in political science and has a burnished social conscience, something she honed teaching creative writing in a woman's prison. But Kate's most salient and at this point defining generational trait might be that she doesn't have a full-time job. Instead, she has been an intern for a year and a half. She had one internship at a political organization and another at a media company and is now an unpaid intern at a lobbying firm. To make ends meet, she works as a hostess 3 or 4 nights a week, which means she often clocks 15-hour days. I don't mean to sound like I have an ego, but I am an intelligent, hard-working person, Kate says. Someone would be happy they hired me. It's a refrain heard many times from the millions of 20-something Kates who are scrambling to find jobs with a steady paycheck and benefits. After all, who wants to still be an intern at age when you should have a 401k and a modicum of job security, or at least be earning more than you did at your summer job during high school? People my age expect to start at the bottom, Kate said, but in this economy, the bottom keeps getting lower and lower. When I ask Kate how many jobs she's applied for, she says, like a million. Desperate as she is, the Department of Labor doesn't consider her to be unemployed because she has 2 jobs. Instead, Kate, who often works more than 60 hours a week, is in a class of workers who don't show up in government reports. She's one of the perm-materns, those perpetual interns, mostly in their 20s, who have been battered by the recession and are holding out hope that the conventional career wisdom that an internship leads to a job isn't folklore from a bygone era. The serial intern isn't unique to D.C. You can find young people languishing at film studios in Los Angeles and magazine empires in New York City. The permaturn phenomena points towards wider trends in the economy, namely the cutthroat competition for knowledge economy jobs, the lack of investment in this generation, and the skills gap between what a generation weaned on a liberal arts education is trained for and what the in-demand skills and professions are right now, i.e. not another poli-sci or English major. The result, for many in Washington, the American dream starts with a highbrow internship that pays $4.35 an hour, then another, and maybe another. That's how much Jessica Schulberg, 22, made for the 10 months she worked at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, a haven for academics and journalists researching public policy issues. Every month, before taxes, Jessica was paid a stipend of $700, supplemented by waitressing and bartending. "I felt like 10 months was a long time to be there," says Jessica, but with only a bachelor's degree, she felt she wasn't qualified for many entry-level jobs, a suspicion confirmed by numerous rejections. The places where she was applying, think tanks and nonprofits, were all receiving a million applications from people just like me, she says. So Jessica went with Plan B, 2 years of graduate school to earn a master's in international politics. A partial scholarship made the decision easier, but Jessica says she'll have to go into debt to cover some of the $50,000 a year in tuition. She'll graduate next year. Somewhat amazingly, Jessica is upbeat about her situation. The internship at the Wilson Center made her feel like one of the lucky ones. During her stint, she assisted foreign policy heavyweights like Michael Adler, a foreign correspondent for Agence France-Presse, on a book about diplomacy in Iran. She did research for Mark Mazzetti, a national security correspondent for the New York Times. When did lucky become working for below minimum wage for months? Jessica doesn't pause when I ask her this. It's clearly a bargain she has mulled many times. You either do what you like to do for free, or you have an entry-level job for $25,000 where you answer the phone and are someone's assistant. Has it always been this hard to break into even the most competitive jobs in D.C.? In a word, no. Take Mazem, 38, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. When he was starting out, Mazzetti interned at the Economist Washington Bureau. In the old days, there were internships in journalism that gave paths to more regular jobs, he says. His internship turned into a position that sent him to Austin. "I could pay the rent, and it was a blast," he recalls. It does seem like, in general, it is harder to get anything full-time and permanent in Washington now because of the economy, Mazzetti says. Young and incredibly smart people have to take jobs for no money or very little money. Internship coordinators around town say they're seeing more applicants with advanced degrees and previous internships than in the past. But the full-time jobs that are supposed to follow prestigious internships aren't as plentiful as they once were. A 2012 study by consulting firm Millennial Branding found that while 91% of the 225 surveyed employers said students should have 1 to 2 internships before they graduate, half of the employers hadn't hired any interns in the previous 6 months. In other words, internships don't always lead to a job offer. Those internships that offer a path to a full-time position are that much more competitive. At the Atlantic Media Company, which publishes The Atlantic and several other magazines, a high percentage of fellows move into other roles in the organization. But an internship at the company is among the toughest to land. The company receives 1,000 resumes for every 25 positions. That's about a 2% acceptance rate. After hearing these numbers, I began to understand why Jessica felt lucky. Maybe she is fortunate to be earning $4.35 an hour at her ivory tower job while she works nights and weekends as a waitress. Maybe a 10-month paid internship followed by graduate school and then perhaps another internship is the new lucky. particularly at a time when so many young people can't find work at all. Still, I wondered, where was the anger at the injustice that a smart young woman couldn't find a permanent job and had to keep prolonging her $4.35 an hour internship? I don't think you can be angry, Jessica says. It's just how it is. People older than me are struggling. Ross Perlin, 29, author of Intern Nation, views the situation as much more insidious. Low-paid and underpaid work is the new normal, Perlin says, and if you can't do those internships, you may be totally shut out of certain fields. How is that fair? The economics of being a permittern are pretty brutal. Thanks to the Affordable Care Act, Jessica can stay on her parents' health insurance until she's 26, defraying a major expense. Without that safety net, it's unclear what she'd do, either forego health insurance or ask for a subsidy from her parents who can't afford many bailouts for their daughter. The job market hasn't always been structured in a way that requires college graduates to work for less than a barista for months or years on end. Perlin says that before the internship boom in the 1950s and 60s, the expectation was that employers would invest in young people and that they, in turn, would pay the investment back by becoming taxpayers and active members of society. There has been a cultural shift towards something more sinister, that you have to invest in yourself, and we are each out there on our own, Perlin explains. There's no idea of a social investment in our promising young people. Increasingly, you invest in your own human capital, or your family does. There is no sense of shared responsibility. But aren't there jobs for the hordes of serial interns? Don't they just need to lower their sights? No one, after all, is forcing them into professions that make getting into Harvard look easy. Isn't this just another example of the entitled Gen Y attitude that sees some work as beneath them? Kate maintains she isn't holding out for the perfect job, but she will wait until she gets a career-building job, a luxury she has as the child of 60s idealist, and, more important, one with no student loans. And she points out that according to a recent poll, her college major, political science, is among the least employable due to a saturation in the marketplace. Not everyone in the generation meets such a fate. Jessica's brother, who's 28 and a mechanical aerospace engineer, has been gainfully employed since the day he graduated from college, Jessica says. So here's another chasm in the 20-something cohort. The one between the liberal arts kids and the engineering and science majors. Engineering is an in-demand skill, Jessica says. International relations policy kids are a dime a dozen. So the intern pay difference makes sense in that regard. The expectation that one's career should be fulfilling is another reason why the mid-20s or even early 30s intern has become a familiar sight in Washington offices. People in this generation, despite the recession, are looking for what they really want to do, so they take a hit in the form of an internship to land one of those coveted jobs that pays the bills and is fun, said Brian Healy of career advice site BrazenCareerist.com. But Aaron Smith of youth advocacy organization Young Invincibles sees permaterns to be a result of the economic rugs being pulled out from under this generation. The economy needs to add a really high number of youth jobs over the next 10 years to get us back to where we were before, he says. Like others, Smith sees a mismatch between the jobs that are available and what young people are seeking and trained for. There is a huge demand for people in science, engineering, and math, and we don't produce enough of those graduates to fill that need, Smith says. Students need to be more cognizant of the labor market. But as long as Washington continues to be a hub of politics, media, nonprofits, and development agencies, young people will continue to flock here to elbow their way into the region's uber-competitive ecosystems. They just might find that interning for a year or two is part of the long, hard slog into the permanent, full-time workforce, or they'll give up or go with Plan B. On the bright side, Lauren Berger, founder of InternQueen.com, a website that helps students find internships, says she isn't seeing serial interns as much as she did during the peak of the recession in 2008 and 2009. She says that when she gets emails from people who have been interning for 4 years, she replies, "Enough with the internships already." If only some had that choice. That takes us to the section of the magazine entitled Talking Points, and here we have two articles, one entitled Immigration, the GOP's New Tune, the second of which is called Housework, Should Men Do More? The GOP is having a change of heart on immigration, said Susan Milligan on USNews.com. Stung by their drubbing in the 2012 presidential election, Republicans have finally realized that unless they start wooing Hispanic voters, they will have a very hard time winning another national election. One of the most dramatic about-faces came from Tea Party darling Senator Rand Paul, Republican Kentucky, who last week endorsed a path to legal status for the country's 11 million undocumented immigrants. Just 2 years ago, he sought to end birthright citizenship for the children of undocumented immigrants. Even if he's mostly preparing for a 2016 presidential bid, Paul deserves credit for recognizing that Republicans have to steer clear of inflammatory buzzwords like amnesty and self-deportation. He's on the right track, said Albert Sabate in ABCNews.com. A recent poll found that a quarter of Latinos who voted for Obama last year would consider voting Republican if the party helped to pass immigration reform. But backing immigration reform is no ticket to electoral success, said the Washington Times in an editorial. Of course, Republicans have to adapt to the country's changing demographics, but that doesn't necessarily mean they should support putting 11 million illegal immigrants on a path to citizenship. And let's not overlook the irony here, said Matthew Cooper in NationalJournal.com. The Republicans' new tack could end up having the unintended effect of delivering millions of new voters to their opponents. Republicans like to believe that Hispanics lean conservative with a devotion to family and hard work, but on issues like gay rights, health care, and the economy, Hispanics tend to stand with the Democrats. The GOP will have to change its tune on more than just immigration to win over America's fastest-growing demographic bloc. It's no surprise that the GOP would love to shed its anti-immigrant label, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. But there's far less to this attempted political makeover than meets the eye. Many rank-and-file Republicans remain deeply ambivalent about backing any proposal that gives undocumented immigrants legal status, much less citizenship, for fear of antagonizing the party's traditional white male base. Look closely and you'll see what immigration advocate Frank Sherry sees, that Republicans are just trying to make it look as if they're being nice to Latinos, even as they make the path to citizenship long, hard, and even unattainable. And under the Housework, Should Men Do More article, we have this. Cleaning is still very much women's work, said Jessica Gross in New Republic, and it's not fair. Men are starting to do their share of cooking and childcare, especially when both parents work full-time. But when it comes to cleaning, most of them are like my husband, who's never scrubbed a toilet in the 6 years we've lived together. Some 55% of working mothers do housework on an average day, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, compared with 18% of employed fathers. Why has cleaning remained the final frontier? Maybe it's the responsibility that women have been conditioned to feel for the state of their homes and the fact that they're judged for it. But cleaning obviously isn't as fun as the housework that modern man has made his own, like cooking, an elaborate meal, or reading your kid a bedtime story. With all these obstacles to real gender parity of chores, what's a working woman to do? Try living like men, said Jonathan Chait and NewYorkMagazine.com. That's NYMAG.com. It's a simple fact of life that women generally have higher standards of cleanliness than men do. Women see filth and grime where we men don't. And when we don't see it, we tend to care about it less. But who's to say that the correct level of cleanliness should be determined by the female alone? In a relationship where two people disagree on what constitutes a clean home, one person is bound to spend more time cleaning than the other. The only way to correct that imbalance is to converge on each other's level of tidiness. So relax. Put down the duster. It'll be okay. Patronizing us is no answer, said Alexandra Brander in The Atlantic. Ever since mothers started working outside the home, we've picked up the slack for both partners. That's got to end. It's stressful enough to juggle the demands of your children and your employer without the pressures of being a maid, too. My suggestion is to split housework duties down the middle. Women draw up a list of invisible tasks, the kind of routine cleaning chores that men like Chait simply do not see, and then divide it. Men agree to do your share, not because you're obligated to rectify an injustice, but because you can. And if the man in your life won't even consider sharing the burden of keeping house, said Tracy Moore in Jezebel.com, you have bigger issues to solve than a dirty kitchen floor. Takes us to the section of the magazine entitled Poll Watch. We also have a couple from Wit and Wisdom here as well. First, though, Poll Watch. Turns out that 64% of Americans believe that same-sex couples are as likely to be good parents as heterosexual couples are. That's up from 54% in 2003. 14% of Americans have changed their views in favor of same-sex marriage over the last decade, and 32% of those said they'd done so because someone they know is a homosexual. That's from the Pew Research Center. And then there's this. 47% of Americans say they favor stricter gun control laws, and that's down from a high of 57% in December after the Newtown, Connecticut shootings. And that's from CBS. And under Wit and Wisdom, we have a couple of entries. He who is too eager to preserve his originality is already losing it. And that's from German composer Robert Schumann, quoted in the Boston Globe. And finally, leadership is the art of accomplishing more than the science of management says is possible. And that's from Colin Powell, quoted in the Nashville Tennessean. And that takes us to Health and Science, and we have this article entitled A Dementia Epidemic. Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia are afflicting far more Americans than ever before. An alarming new report by the Alzheimer's Association shows that 1 in 3 seniors have dementia when they die, and deaths from the disease increased nearly 70% between 2000 and 2010. It's an epidemic. It's on the rise, and currently there is no way to delay it, prevent it, or cure it, neuroscientist Maria Carrillo tells NPR.org. As deaths from diseases like cancer, AIDS, and stroke have declined, Alzheimer's rates have risen because people are living longer. Some 5 million Americans now have Alzheimer's or related dementia, and as baby boomers age, that figure is expected to jump to nearly 14 million by 2050. As simply staggering as those numbers are, says Francis Collins, director of the National Institutes of Health, funding for Alzheimer's research still lags far behind the billions allocated for treating and curing AIDS, diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. Researchers say many people don't realize that Alzheimer's devastates the body, including lowering a person's ability to fight infection, as well as the mind, making the disease not just disabling, but deadly. And then we have this piece entitled Only in America. An Ohio prosecutor sought the death penalty for Punxsutawney Phil, saying the famous groundhog misled millions of people by predicting an early spring. Phil has let us down, said Michael Gemoser. I awoke this morning to a snowstorm, low temperatures, and howling wind. Gemoser dropped the suit after Phil's handlers took responsibility for the error. And we end today's reading with a somewhat upbeat entry. It wasn't all bad. When Lindsay Crumbly Scanlon lost her underwater camera in the waters off Maui, Hawaii in 2007, she figured her precious vacation photos were gone forever. But 6 years later, Scallion's camera washed up on a beach over 5,200 miles away in Taiwan with its memory card intact. Scallion was identified after pictures of her from the camera were shown on TV in the U.S. The grime-encrusted camera was discovered by an employee of China Airlines, which has offered to fly Scallion to Taiwan to collect it and her long-lost pictures. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, filling in for George Douglas. Triangle Radio Reading Services wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long. Until next time.